We spent a bit of time this year, which is pretty typical for our Dharma talks, focusing on the Satipatthana Sutta, the four foundations of mindfulness. And we've worked our way up to the fourth foundation. Four foundations, first of all, are mindfulness of the body, physical sensations, what it's like to inhabit a body and hear things and see things. Mindfulness of body is quite relevant to today's topic. Second foundation, mindfulness of feelings, which is also pretty relevant. And feelings are not emotions. It's what's called an affect drive, an urgency toward wanting something or an urgency toward getting away from something, getting rid of something. The third foundation is mindfulness of the mind, the quality of consciousness that's operating in a given moment. Is the mind alert or dull, driven or at peace, so forth and so on. And the fourth foundation is mindfulness of mental phenomena, dhammanupassana. We in that regard, previous talk focused on the first and fourth foundation, which is the five hindrances, then the last week I talked about the five aggregates of clinging, and tonight I'm going to be talking about the six sense doors and the fetters that bind them. And next week, we're going to start to review the seven awakening factors. That'll involve more than one meeting. So, the last week's factor, five, or topic, the five aggregates of clinging, is a way to deconstruct the personality. Analytically, cognitively, to think about the mind, how its different elements come together in the same way that different elements come together to form concrete or cement. And tonight's topic is also about draining the energy away from a sense of there being an enduring autonomous self. So here's what it says in the Satipatthana Sutta from a translation in Anallio's authoritative book, Satipatthana, The Direct Path to Realization. Sense spheres. Again, monks, in regard to dhammas, he abides contemplating dhammas in terms of the six internal and external sense spheres. And how does he, in regard to dhammas, abide contemplating dhammas in terms of the six internal and external sense spheres? Here, he knows the eye, he knows forms, and he knows the fetter that arises dependent on both. And he also knows how an unarisen fetter can arise, how an arisen fetter can be removed, and how a future arising of the removed fetter can be prevented. He knows the ears, he knows sounds, and he knows the fetter that arises dependent on both. And he also knows how an unarisen fetter can arise, how an arisen fetter can be removed, and how a future arising of the removed fetter can be prevented. He knows the nose, he knows odors, and he knows the fetter that arises, dependent on both. And he also knows how an unarisen fetter can arise, how an arisen fetter can be removed, and how a future arising of the removed fetter can be prevented. He knows the tongue. He knows flavors. And he knows the fetter that arises, dependent on both. And he also knows how an unarisen fetter can arise, how an arisen fetter can be removed, and how a future arising of the future and how the future arising of the removed fetter can be prevented. He knows the body. He knows tangibles. And he knows the fetter that arises dependent on both. And he also knows how an unarisen fetter can arise, how an arisen fetter can be removed, and how a future arising of the removed fetter can be prevented. And here's the refrain. The refrain is repeated throughout all of the different stanzas of the sections of the Satipatthana Sutta. They just change it in terms of the particular foundation that it's focused on. In this way, in regard to dhammas, he abides contemplating dhammas internally, externally, internally and externally. He abides contemplating the nature of arising, of passing away, of both arising and passing away in dhammas. Mindfulness that there are dhammas is established in him to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and continuous mindfulness. And he abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. That is how, in regard to dhammas, he abides contemplating dhammas in terms of the six internal and external sense spheres. Now, there's only five there. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and the sensations in a body, embodied experience. The sixth one is mind, mental objects, right? So, mental objects are dhammas. Now, why is that distinction important? There's another important insight to be cultivated in this practice, which is nama-rupa. Rupa is form, and this goes back to the talk last week. It's one of the five aggregates. Form in this context is light, sound, odor, flavor, and somatosensory experience, heat, pressure, fatigue, so forth and so on. Just really embodied responses rather than what the mind makes of them. And what the mind makes of them is nama. And so that awareness, it's called awareness of or insight regarding nama rupa. And it focuses in on this particular part of the Satipatthana Sutta, the six sense bases and the fetters. So perceptions, feelings, and the selfing story, beliefs, all of those are nama. So what's a fetter? Well, back in the horse and buggy days, you fettered your horse by tying it to a hitching post or hobbling their legs so they couldn't move very far. In Buddhism, a fetter is what binds the flow of experience. Through the process of craving and clinging, this binding together occurs. And of course, being aware of craving and clinging and its the result, which is dukkha, is a core, a part of Buddhist teaching. The most predominant examples of the fetters are the five hindrances, which was talked about a couple of weeks ago. So, classical Buddhism, Theravadan Buddhism, considers 10 fetters. First one is belief in a self. This is the most basic misperception humans are confronted with. We can call it ego defense or ego gratification. This belief is just simply a construct of neural patterns in the brain. I'll be talking more about that in a few minutes. Before I go further talking about the fetters, a lot of what the fetters were created to address were cultural issues in this spiritual culture of the time, Theravada Buddhism, in the early days of Buddhism, the early centuries. So they had to use the norms, the beliefs about gods and about nature that were prevalent in society at the time to create a language that could describe the path toward awakening. I think that our challenge in this generation and generations to come is to find a new kind of cultural rationalization to describe or explain why this process is valid and impactful. And it's neuroscience. So I've been studying a lot of neuroscience lately, talking about it for years now, actually. And that's going to be part of what I'm going to talk about in a few minutes. But in terms of the description of the fetters, belief in itself is an integrated function that pulls together a notion that, you know, I have an identity I've known it all my life, certain continuity there. Although lately I must admit, I do not look like or think like I did when I was young. That's abundantly clear. So which self is the real self, right? The second of the fetters is doubt or uncertainty, particularly about the Buddha's awakening. So there can be doubt, and this was talked about in terms of the hindrance of doubt, skeptical doubt. There's one thing to be able to understand or create a conceptual structure that describes human experience. It's a whole nother thing to actually be directly subjectively aware of it in a way that confirms those concepts, makes them valid. So this is doubt about that. The more I practice, the less I doubt that this is valid. This is a really important way for me to live personally. And it's organized around, I live a pretty normal life. I watch television, I go to the gym, I get groceries, I'm married and so forth and so on. But when the fetters were first talked about in early Buddhism, you either were a homeowner or you were a renunciate in the context of Buddhist practice, particularly Theravada Buddhism. So doubt might interfere with someone's willingness to commit because it meant a lot of sacrifice in terms of lifestyle. I've made sacrifices in terms of my lifestyle, but I don't really regard them as sacrifices. I regard them as beneficial decisions about how to live, call it right lifestyle. So doubt or uncertainty is resolved the more you go deeply into your own subjectivity using the tools and the concepts of mindfulness and other aspects of the path. Third one is attachment to rites and rituals. Back in the day, they were contending with the Brahmanic culture, which we know today as Hinduism. there were Brahmin priests, and they were in charge of the sacred literature and the sacred rituals and so forth and so on. And one of the things that the Buddha realized was that there is this limited value to them, that they might be useful for kind of collecting one's focus of life, but ultimately to be liberated from craving and clinging, we have to let go of all of our rites and rituals, including what it means to dress well or to be a success in life. We live in a very materialistic culture, and a lot of what people do in this culture is, in a sense, almost ritualistic. Different routines that we take on that are pretty much because they're cultural norms, not because they inherently are useful or even healthy. So, attachment to rites and rituals, we want to be able to investigate them and not be fettered by them. That doesn't mean that, I should dress inappropriately or behave in antisocial ways, but the choices about how to dress and how to behave come from a different kind of decision-making process. The next of the fetters is, one of the most important hindrances, sensual desire. And sensual desire is not just about sex. It's about any physical sensation, seeing, hearing, so forth and so on, that brings pleasure, that draws one in terms of contemporary psychology. It's called affect approach. In other words, there's a feeling of urgency and impulsive reactivity that causes a person to act to have more of that or fulfill the potential of it. So it could be about your status, could be about a favorite TV show, could be about favorite flavor, so forth and so on. That's sensual desire as well. Ill will, another one of the hindrances, is kind of the opposite of sensual desire in terms of affect. It's, in fact, it's called affect avoidance. Something that the light hits the eye, the mind interprets it as a threat or as at least as unpleasant. And so there's this rigidity with rejection and avoidance because of the unpleasant feeling. Interestingly enough, in our culture, ill will and joy are often used to manipulate people. Actually, I think I make comment of it in here. I've certainly been thinking about it. I will comment about it now. It's ironic when I watch shows that are particularly dramatic shows or ones that are likely to promote feeling of aversion or anger or fear. And a commercial will interrupt, and it'll be some smiling, happy face with a new car or new clothes or new perfume or a new improved whatever, right? So that's a basic element for an addictive lifestyle. We live in stressful times. One of the ways that we are tempted to try to manage that stress through is buying things, eating things, smoking things, drinking things, watching things. So that's a dichotomy that's really important in terms of fettering the belief that there's an enduring autonomous self, that somehow craving and clinging is the right thing to do. But craving can be about wanting something, but craving can also be not wanting something. It's a felt sense of impulsive reactivity. The next of the fetters is lust for material existence or lust for material rebirth. This is perhaps one of the most archaic fetters. So, in thinking about this for tonight's talk, what I consider was it's not about rebirth, it's more about improving one's life, right? A chance to start over. An impulsive act that is going to bring you fame and fortune, right? So thinking about that as a kind of rebirth, someday I'm going to be rich and famous, right? So our culture really conditions for that. The next of the fetters is lust for immaterial existence, lust for rebirth in a formless realm. This is probably the least useful fetter concept. Basically, it had to do with levels of concentration, jhana states, that basically were wonderful refuges from the stresses and strains of life, as long as the conditions supported you remaining in jhana. And jhana ended, you know, the world came crashing back in. Also, Buddhist's world, conceptual world, has heavens and hells. There are actually several heavens, a couple of heavens and a couple of hells. So that's part of the cultural norm back then. And the millions of people obviously have that hope, that belief these days as well, that they're doing this so that they won't go, whatever they're going to do, so they won't go to hell, they'll go to heaven. But the Buddha said that it's not the issue of whether there's such a thing as a heaven or hell. How do you live your life right now? The whole issue of heaven or hell is going to resolve itself. But address the issue of dukkha in your life right now, and everything will fall into place. The next of the fetters is conceit. It's about selfishness or self-absorption. We normally think of conceit as only as describing someone who's arrogant. But it's also true for someone who thinks poorly of themselves. That's also a conceit. Because conceit basically is something that's an attachment to a particular identity. It's imagined. When I was in college, I was an English major, and I obviously had to study English literature. And at a certain time in English history, poetry was called a conceit. And what that meant was just an imagined descriptive of some sort about a person or a place or a thing. That was a conceit. So contemporary English is applying that to this particular fetter. And in terms of the process of awakening, conceit is, you know, overcoming conceit, seeing through it, dissolving it, is what leads to emancipation from the belief that there's an enduring self. So traditionally, when a person the first time they experienced nirvana, called stream enterers, any doubt about the path goes away, because you really understand, oh yeah, this is what the guy was talking about. I know it. It's about conceit, the belief that there's an enduring autonomous self. So those three fetters are dissolved. And then according to Theravadan Buddhist concepts, there are three more stream entry. I mean, three more experiences of nirvana. The fourth of them is absolute nirvana. No fetters left at all. Some of the fetters come back after the first experience of nirvana. I'm not going to talk about that. Once again, I think that that's all well and good, but what it amounts to is, what am I paying attention to right now, and what kind of way am I paying attention to it? That's the issue. The next of the fetters is restlessness. Life is inherently uncertain, even on a cellular level. What I mean by that is, We live in an environment that's internal and external, both internal and external, to follow the quote from the Sutta. But what I mean by that is our experience as an embodied being includes millions of other entities, bacteria, fungi, different kinds of creatures that live inside the human body and on the skin, on our skin. They could not live without us. We need them to live. And so our restlessness is kind of existential. These different biomes constantly challenged to continue to function. It's kind of miraculous that we do. But that's part of restlessness. There's also something that goes on in the nervous system that is unsettled. It has to do with the flow of energy through the brain and the body. It's unsettled. Now, that can be made tranquil. It's one of the seven awakening factors. The energy is still there, but it's not scattered or jagged. It's more smoothed out. It's still there. But understanding that energy and how it is experienced without attachment is what we're talking about in terms of dissolving that particular fetter. And the final fetter, the key fetter, is ignorance. Ignorance regarding craving and clinging. It's the driving factor regarding dukkha, stress, and confusion of life. Okay, so now I've described what the fetters are. And by the way, different systems in early Buddhism have different allocations. I'm just using what was in Anallio's book. But there are different enumerations of them. There are fewer of them, or there are more of them. So just once again, Buddhism has been trying to develop a set of analytical concepts and then training the mind to be sufficiently alert to and tranquil to actually pay attention to how these concepts might work. And that's what the path is all about. And I mentioned that there's a traditional understanding of how this works out. There's also a contemporary neurological understanding. And this is in the context of the fetters. So, from a Buddhist psychology perspective, oh, by the way, I had AI help me with this. I downloaded some stuff from AI and I went through and revised it to suit my understanding. The Buddhist Abhidhamma tradition analyzes minds into rapid, discrete events called cittas. A moment of consciousness, which is extremely brief and has a kind of bound aspect to it. And here are the elements of that in terms of understanding the fetters. First, and this is pretty much following the five aggregates, there's a sensory base. Light or sound or whatever, a corresponding sense door, which might be the eye and the initial optical processing of light as it stimulates the eye. The feeling tone, and this is where it starts to make the shift. Both those two, by the way, first two are rupa, light and the receptivity of the optical process. Then, that's rupa. Nama occurs when feeling is experienced, an affective drive. There's a perception, and a perception in the Buddhist world basically means a singling out of a particular element for attention. As I'm sitting here right now, all the sense gates, except possibly flavor, are being, and odor, are being stimulated in me. So I have feelings of pressure, temperature, movement, you know, how my limbs are arranged, and the sound of my voice, and whatever light is hitting my optical process. Okay, all of that's going on, pouring in these different, through these different bases, the eye base, the ear base, et cetera, et cetera. Well, perception starts to single out one particular element of that for further development and attention. At any given moment, it might be my mind organized around a particular arrangement of light and seeing it as the door to the other room, the cabinet in the other room, et cetera, et cetera. Or the sound and feel of my voice as I'm speaking, right? So that's going on. And the perception is excluding that feeling of pressure or other potential objects to look at or listen to. That's what perception is. And then are mental formations. Mental formations basically are memories, intentions, plans, projections into the future, et cetera, et cetera. So how is that bound together? Well, from a neuroscientific perspective, leaving behind the Buddhist thing, Buddhism actually talks about a binding moment of consciousness, by the way. Those of you who participated in the study groups that I've led that are organized around a book called The Mind Illuminated, persons who wrote that book were very experienced psychologists and meditation practitioners. And so they actually describe a lot of what I'm talking about in neurological terms, but also from a Buddhist perspective. Okay, so here's the neuroscience. How does the brain combine distributed processing into a single experience? For example, and I'm reiterating what I said a minute ago, colors processed in one particular area of the brain. We know this from contemporary research. Motion in a different area, shape in a different area, and emotional valence. The attention grabbing quality via what's called the limbic system. So all these different systems, there's an optical system, there's an emotional system, there's a behavioral system, there's a central processing unit system, it's called the thalamus. There's the preorbital cortex, the front of the brain, which basically is the go, no go executive function. All these different processes are going on. And yet, subjectively, there's a coherence to this moment of selfing. So we don't see these separate streams. We don't perceive them. Actually, when deep in meditation practice, it's possible to really understand subjectively what I'm describing. You can see it happening. Talk more about that in a few minutes. So looking at an apple, we don't see red or round as separate streams. Tactile sense or odor or flavor. Those are all happening in different areas of the brain. Now, that is the binding. So I mentioned a few minutes ago something called the thalamus. Thalamus is a cluster of neural nuclei and connecting neurons. It's in layers like an onion. Different layers in different areas, front, back, side, so forth, have different kinds of integrative functions. So a signal comes in from one of these different sensory areas in the brain. It comes in and it kind of gets stirred around in the thalamus. Then it goes back out, comes back in, goes back out multiple times a second. During that, each one of those signals has a certain kind of frequency and amplitude. Frequency is how many times the cycles occur a second. Amplitude is how strong or weak those signals are. They start to synchronize. This is all happening multiple times a second, over and over and over and over again. They synchronize. And the best fit, the most harmonious intersection or integration among these different sensory processes is what is what produces the binding moment. Okay. So what two of the different contributors to this, because part of what's going on in that loop is memory, comparisons between what's actually going on in the brain right now and previous impressions. It could go back over the course of a lifetime. Most of them not in conscious awareness. Saying this, I'm remembering, there are times when I've been on retreats when I will have memories from 70 years ago, right? They just somehow or other pop in. Where did they come from? Right? Well, that's that kind of vagueness of how the brain cells, the neural patterns interact. But they get bound together. So one of the ways that I describe it, have described it before, is actually ChatGPT touched on this too. Back in the day, when you went to a movie house, there was a strip of celluloid film you couldn't see. It was in the projection room. Had a bunch of still images on it. They all looked the same, unless there was an editing cut. You switched from one scene to another abruptly, in which case they had cut the celluloid strip and then taped it back together so that it would fit into the projector. Projector would run at a certain speed, certain kind of light, certain kind of focus. So these images would flash on the screen discreetly multiple times a second. But because of the binding moment of visual processing and emotional processing and understanding narrative processing, all of those would bind together, those different discrete images combined with sound that was synchronized with what was going on in the visual part of the film. And the mind would bind all this together into a comprehensive story and would bind into I like it, I don't like it kinds of experiences. That's the binding moment of consciousness. But it's a stream. It goes on all the time. Now, how does that happen? Because of what's called the eidetic process. If you look at a candle flame for 5 or 10 minutes and close your eyes, there will be a reciprocal image, same size, different color in your mind's eye with your eyes closed. Call that an eidetic image. What's really going on is those optical processes have been overstimulated. The nerves are firing like mad, right? The neural pathways are streaming with energy. So it persists. It's not like an on-off switch. It's more like a dimmer, right? And eventually, those cells stop activating, and that image of a candle flame dissipates. My assumption, I don't know if this is actually validated in neurological research, that goes on all the time. In terms of visual processing, auditory processing, et cetera, et cetera. It's just not as vivid in awareness, and it doesn't last as long. I imagine that if we could tune into the sound and all you could hear is one sound for 5 minutes and you stop listening to it, there might be some kind of ongoing reverberation in there. Maybe that's what earworms are about, right? The repeated songs that we all struggle with from time to time. So that's the binding moment of consciousness. And that's what the fetters are all about, is that binding. I think it's important to understand that conceptually. And to bring our meditation practice to bear on it. How do we do this? Well, basic instruction, mindfulness of breathing, and it's mindfulness of the body. It's no accident that mindfulness of the body is the first of the four foundations, because it is the most obviously accessible and uncomplicated part. We have body sensations all the time. Well, not all the time, but almost all the time. We're so accustomed to it that we don't really pay attention that much to where our hands are, or feelings of pressure on from cloth on skin, so forth and so on, right? But the most important aspect of mindfulness of the body is mindfulness of breathing. And there's a reason for this. Now, part of what drives the binding moments, I mentioned earlier, it could either be a conditioning that you've been repeatedly exposed to, or a strong feeling tone. If you were absolutely delighted by early interactions with a dog, hearing the sound of a dog barking would elicit sense desire. If you were terrorized, bitten by a dog in your childhood, you hear a dog barking, you will experience aversion, and you will, because of those binding moments, those fetters, right? As a matter of fact, you can hear the sound of a dog bark, and it doesn't particularly elicit fear or desire. Just note it as a sound. Maybe you didn't have any experience with a dog, right? So mindfulness investigates that arena, so to speak, and how the sound of a dog barking becomes a self. And that belief is the issue of fetters. But sensation of breathing has no emotional potency, or very little, right? It's there all the time, readily accessible, very simple. Now, when the mind is exposed to an auditory stimulus, there's an immediate assessment in one of those systems. First, there's the sound system. There's also, I mentioned earlier, the limbic system, which basically is assessing friend or foe, food or poison, an initial immediate reaction. It's a kind of reflexive reaction that you would have if you put your hand on something that was hot enough to burn it. You wouldn't have to think about it. Reflexively, you would pull your hand back. That's in a form of aversion, right? So whenever the mind experiences the fetters, there's a level of energy that goes with it, a kind of channeling of energy into that particular bound self, bound moment of selfing. And the level of energy there determines the binding. If there's a very strong emotional valence, it can be a quick and strong bind. If it's minor, it won't be much of a mind at all. Maybe just to notice it. So there's that quality of practice that goes on that creates that restlessness that I was talking about earlier, right? Energy in the system. When you watch the sensation of breathing, there is no push-pull there. There's just sensation. It's pretty much neutral. And you keep bringing your attention there, that signal reverberates back through that thalamocortical loop, and the whole system starts to settle down and stabilize, right? As long as you maintain an engaged interest in what's going to happen with this breath, what's going to happen with this breath, what's going to happen with this breath, that process is reinforced. It becomes another thalamocortical loop, but it has a different kind of characteristic and a different sort of foundation for understanding and responding to rupa, to whatever the eye sees or the ear hears. Okay. So that's really important. Mindfulness of the body is the breath. Mindfulness of feelings is the second foundation. Feelings are neutral. You have to decide to pay attention to it, which is the fourth foundation of mindfulness. And the third foundation of mindfulness, mindfulness of consciousness, the whole system starts to stabilize, become more tranquil, and yet remain alert. That's how this works, okay? That's how the power of the fetters is dissolved. The storyline of the fetter becomes less convincing, and the impulsive reactivity associated with it diminishes. And that's what we're doing when we are noticing the sense doors and the sense fetters and the fetters. One last thing, talk about fetters in terms of visual things. There are also fetters in terms of just pure memory. I mentioned that I might be sitting and meditating with my eyes closed in a quiet room in the middle of a 1 week retreat, and a memory comes up. I have no idea what prompted it. It just comes out of somewhere in my mind and my memory bank, right? Well, the same binding process goes on there. That memory comes up initially and kind of gets reinforced and becomes more vivid and more enticing. But the more I'm able to use the blandness of curiosity, curious investigation of the breath, the more that emerging memory drains of energy. The energy just drains out of it. So ultimately, in this process, this practice, the ultimate binding is the belief that there's a self, that fetter, right? That's what we're trying to dissolve. But if what we do instead, without experiencing nirvana, learning how to manage life more skillfully in terms of ethics and in terms of well-being, wholesome well-being, is significantly enhanced, because the fetters are driving us in all kinds of ways that have spiritual implications, but just simply have lifestyle implications. So that's what I want to say about the fetters, the sixth sense doors and the fetters tonight. Next week, I'm going to be talking about an overview of the awakening factors. And the first three of them in particular, mindfulness, investigation of mental phenomena, and energy in the terms of persistent right effort. And I'm going to bring more of that use of neuroscience to explain what's going on when these awakening factors are operating and when they are integrated. The thing that's interesting about it is that ultimately the integration of the awakening factors is the final binding. We have to rely on the awakening factors to create a state of mind that finally lets go of the whole notion of selfing. And that's when nirvana occurs. So it just occurred to me that that kind of ironic issue. Okay, we have some time left for questions or comments. Anybody have any thoughts about what you heard me say? Any confusion, any insights? Yes, Satish.
I think one of the main fetters is the sense of being a separate self.
Yep.
Right? But then you talk about all this need for to do all this stuff, other stuff.
Right? Right.
So how do you reconcile that?
Well, I want to use a assembly that part of the Buddhist teaching from early on. Two similes, very familiar for a lot of you. One of them is a raft. The river of samsara, right, is the river of fetters. The concepts that are associated with awakening, I've just described them, the fetters and the sense doors, et cetera, et cetera. They're the constituent elements of the raft, right? You use the raft to cross the stream. Then when you're on the other side of the stream, there's no point in carrying the raft anymore. The other simile is that of a thorn. Craving and clinging is a thorn. And dukkha is the pain that we feel. The constructs that I just described in terms of the fetters and how to recognize them and how to drain them of their energy is the other thorn. We use that thorn to dig out the original thorn, throw both thorns away. Does that clarify it?
Yeah, I have heard of that.
So they're all constructs. There's binding, even in the wholesomeness. I've kind of alluded to that when I said that even the seven awakening factors represent binding, right? But one of the things that happens when the seven awakening factors are really fulfilled, they're bound together very elegantly and operationally. What becomes apparent with the first awakening, there is no self. It dissolves the first fetter. That what the Buddha said is true, which is the fetter of doubt, and the fetter of rites and rituals. It's a realization that just paying attention is it. Paying attention and letting go. That's all it takes. There's no ritual there. It's pure subjective, the ultimate subjective insight. Does that help?
That helps. But the ironic thing is something that doesn't exist is able to do all this stuff.
Yep, that's the miracle. That is absolutely the miracle. And the older I get, the more amazed I am at the ultimate miracle of life. Even the life of an ant or a bee. There's a series out now on National Geographic Channel, Disney Plus, I think, about the secrets of the bees. And they're actually taking films of bees close up. So they look really large and inside of a hive and how the bees interact and how intelligent bees are. Bees can solve problems. Bees can transmit complex messages. It's very interesting. So this whole notion of mystery about consciousness is just, I love it. Other questions or comments? John,
I think it's simply observing and learning to distinguish what the body's always done, and humans around the world that congregate will take the time to realize it if they are doing, you know, an observation of looking at what is going on. And that to me is refreshing, that, you know, you can run but you can't hide, and that it's just all, it's sort of given to you on a platter, and you decide whether you're going to do something about it by using these tools that you've been given or not.
Yep.
And I think the smarter the person, the more balanced, smart's not a good word.
No, I would say the more well-trained. People can be incredibly smart and do hurtful things with that intelligence.
Yeah, all right, I'll buy that. I'll use that term. But it's I think, you know, it's like learning to ride a bicycle. It's you have to, you know, walk before you run, and it's just common sense, and it'll catch you everyone if you let it. You know.
Yep. Any final questions or comments before I wrap it up for the evening? It's our custom at the end of our meetings for us to sit together briefly in silence, so let's do that now. Thank you for your practice and wish you well, and I hope that we're safe and happy until the next time we have a chance to chat.